Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This podcast bonus was originally recorded April 2016 in Portland, Oregon.
I have a very short talk. No, you can't get enlightened if you don't think there's a former and future life. That's all, very simple. You know, you don't even qualify as a religious person, according to Atisha, Dongkhapa, everyone, Buddha. Because you're so delusional, and even, but really, you're fine, though, you know. If you don't have a former and future life, you know, you don't need to get enlightened. Because you don't exist, you know? And that's what you're told from Harvard, MIT, Columbia University, all the great sages, Oxford, Richard Dawkins, Carl Sagan, they all tell you that you don't exist. And you don't know that you don't exist because you live as a deluded person running around thinking you exist, and you find out when you die. You return to your natural state, which is non-existence. And it's all settled. No problem.
Then it took me 40 years or 30 years to say, like, okay, that you're not going to exist after you die. What is your evidence? Stop to think about it. And then, first time I thought of that, I said, did Carl Sagan show up and say, hey guys, it's cool, I don't exist. You can be sure now, I'm really sure. I can testify, I don't exist. Did that happen? Actually, could that happen if that were the case? In fact, in principle, there will never be evidence of non-existence, right? Nobody will ever discover non-existence. It doesn't exist. It's not there. Nobody can get into it. Nothing ever goes there. Nothing comes from there. Non-existence means it's nothing. So you can't be nothing. It's impossible. There'll never be proof. Therefore, you can leave your conversation partner in this particular conversation with the fact that is plain in their face that their belief that they will not have a future life is nothing but blind faith without any evidence. Do you get it? Is anybody refuting that? Any argument on that? They propose as a dogmatic blind faith, article of faith that you have to have to be a natural scientist. You cannot get tenure in the United States unless you believe that and subscribe to it. And they are scientists looking for evidence and reason, and there's no evidence and no reason, and that's their article of faith. Is that scientific? It's insane, actually. They believe that nothing is a discovery. And they've discovered it. And they won the Nobel Prize for that. I discovered nothing. But I won a prize. And I assure you, you're all going to be nothing. What is that? Is that sanity? That's the basis of our elite worldview of this culture, of this planet. These are the people who are destroying it. Okay? Climate change. Oh, no, we can't turn that off. We need a lot more light on Times Square in Las Vegas. So we need more power, more energy. We need that. So, yeah, we need subsidies for poor people in the oil industry. They need a $1 trillion subsidy every year. On this planet, all those guys in Paris signing these documents, we're not going to, like, destroy the planet. By 2030, we'll do something. By 2040, we'll do something. After the Greenland ice comes and, like, rolls down Main Street in Portland, we'll do something. They say, And then they are giving, all Russians, American, Chinese, they're giving over $1 trillion of subsidy to burn more carbon fuel. Not only are people paying it and paying for it, but the governments are giving subsidies of over $1 trillion. And nobody can do anything about it. Oh, no. Why? Because they're a bunch of insane psychotics who think they discovered nothing and they are going to be nothing. Do you realize that? Okay? You got that? And then there's one or two of them who purport to be teaching about Buddhism and say that that's what Buddha taught. What do we do with that? What can you say? It's like breathtaking. Buddha said you don't exist? Then why did anybody listen to him? Someone gets up, I don't exist. Eureka. Well, then other people should walk out. If you don't exist, why are you talking? What's the problem? So it isn't really, can you get enlightened without former and future life? It's really, why would you bother? Just shoot yourself. And you don't, and you're back to your reality, which is non-existence. Just stop your brain, that's all. It's too much trouble to carry this brain around. It weighs many pounds. It like burns up a lot of heat, dehydrates you. Why bother? Just shoot yourself. Then you just don't exist. And you know, it's kind of grit your teeth, bang. And then you're simply not there. And you never knew you were there, so nobody's regretting. Right? And some people will regret that you went, and then they won't exist, and they won't regret it. So destroy the whole planet. Why not? Who cares? It's all non-existent. Do you follow me? This is a bunch of psychos on this planet. You know, Tony Perkins with a knife running around in the shower, chasing somebody. That is, we have to face that, actually. It's nice to be polite. Oh, let's talk to them. Oh, they're so brilliant. They make hydrogen bombs. They must be smart. They drop them, even. They give the trigger to, like, you know, psychological giants like W. Or Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin. I mean, you know, we have to face where we are, which means that those who have a little sense about it have to be vigorous in pursuing the positive, right? Because obviously, without a miracle, there's no way of moving along. And therefore, in a political revolution that Mr. Bernie is calling for, everybody's Jewish uncle from Brooklyn, he's calling for a political revolution, but that's to forestall a real revolution, a violent one, which will come if they continue to behave like this. Okay? So that's the main thesis. So that's it. Then we can pack up and go and take a break. You get it? Anybody questioning that? Nothing doesn't exist. It's a non-referring word. If you ask somebody, I've done this in large audiences around the country, and I've said, how many people here are afraid of nothing? A lot of people go like that. And then I say to them, it's a little trick, you know, I don't need to do it with you all, because you all are properly paranoid about your future life, and you want to make sure it's not in a bad situation. You would prefer to be reborn in Oregon, where you have a chance to vote. And where you have a beautiful green valley, and you're not being persecuted by, like, Alec, or the Koch brothers, or, you know, they're insane people. You know, more insane people. So you'd like to know that. And you're worried, you know, and you don't want to watch too much TV about, you know, Georgia or something, because you might get hypnotized by some place there and then die and be reborn in Georgia. Or in Alabama or something. Right? So you're all nervous, and you're all, you know there's a consequence to what you think, what you do, and what you say. So therefore, you're already cool, you know? You're already cool. You don't think that you're nothing. You don't make the excuse that you're nothing. But unfortunately, you know, we although we consciously have that belief, we are brought up in science, not in churches and synagogues and things, but in science classes, in our education. And we are brought up with a sort of feeling that really what's real is just the matter around us. and these things about the future life, well, maybe, maybe not. Some people go around indulging, say, I'm an agnostic, I don't really know. It doesn't matter if you don't really know. The point is, if you're nothing, you know, you're not going to regret if you are paranoid and you make an effort to book your future life. Like if you go somewhere on an airplane, you book your hotel room, you book your destination, you take your passport, you make preparations. You don't mess around because you don't want to land somewhere and have to sleep in the street, right? So we're all going somewhere, we're all going to die, right? You know that. That's not rude in a Buddhist center to say, because everybody here has meditated, right? You know, Deljon Nyeka Tsela Longmepa. How many of you know that by heart? Jadamprache's Tsongkhapa's, you know, three principles of the path, you know. Deljon Nyeka. It's very hard to find this human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, or whatever people, however they want to translate it, right? And there is no time in life. Think of those things again and again, and you will turn off, you will reverse your obsession with this life. That's the foundation of the path, right? That means, right? You all know that. Everybody know that one? Have you all meditated on that? Yeah? Deljon Nyeka, do you realize how valuable you are, everyone? You do? Do you think that your time, therefore, is as valuable as Warren Buffett's, who in a minute could lose $1 billion if he's not alert? Do you think your time is like that, or do you wait for things? Do you pass the time? Do you sort of, you know, spend your time? Do you think it's valuable like that? If you feel that your body and your brain and your mind is so valuable because you are this beautiful human being that you are, if you feel that, you're not going to waste your time. You might even go down to Maitripa to listen to some overworked and somewhat hoarse person from New York telling you what you already know, hopefully. But this is the thing about that meditation, about the preciousness of human life, where the path begins. The reason people don't use their life, you know, and by the way, Buddhism is not mainly meditation. Do you know the Eightfold Path? What is the first branch of the Eightfold Path? The first one. Is it meditation? Is it mindfulness? No. Why not? If that's the main thing. The first branch is realistic worldview. Right? Yandak Bitawa, Samyak Drishti, which I learned from Alan Wallace, is better translated as realistic than right. Right is not good because right is like following the rule. I'm right, you're wrong. It's not a matter of being right according to some prescription. It's a matter of being realistic according to reality. Samyak means, you know. It's Sanskrit. It's not about some yak. This man here is a yak. Okay, so he just like took off his horns.
I'm hoping
for the moment. For the moment. So okay. So, but the thing is, when you meditate on a theme like that, let me tell a story. My guru, my original guru, was a Mongolian gentleman named Geshe Wangyal. And he was a clairvoyant person, very enlightened person, and a geshe from Drebung, Gomang. But he had clairvoyance. And when I would go meditate in my early years of study, which I was dying to do, because I was frightened of life, and I was trying to get away from it as much as I could, and I especially liked meditations where I had like that lifting feeling, and I sort of got away from my body, and I was hoping to get away from it permanently, and everything else. And that guy had radar, and at 3 in the morning in a bush out behind the monastery, I'd be out there trying to meditate, and he would show up and say, oh, you can't plant at night, it's dark. You don't, what are you doing? Are you weeding the bush? Get out of here, let's go have yogurt. And this one time I'd been studying a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, I thought I was really like, I was meditating, I sneaked out 3 in the morning in the temple, and I was like, meditating, we had a candle, you know, the Buddha was there, like a big Buddha like that. Switches on the light and thing, what are you doing? What do you mean, what am I doing? I'm a Buddhist monk, I'm meditating. Why are you meditating? What do you mean, why am I meditating? I'm a Buddhist monk, I want to get enlightened, he said. Oh, he said, you can't get enlightened, you're an American. I said, I said, what do you mean? I mean, I was in America. Now I'm like a Buddhist monk. You know, I have a shaved head. You know, little did I know, years later, my daughter would say that I looked like Henry Miller in drag. But anyway, I was like very gung-ho. And he says, you're an American. I said, what do you mean I'm an American? I don't have American attitudes. I believe in former and future life. He says, no. You're an American. And when you to get enlightened, you have to have a mind. And you Americans don't think you have a mind. He said, and then I argued violently, and we went on for days and weeks arguing. And of course, he was absolutely right. So when you meditate on your belief in your former and future life, the way you do it is you combine shamatha and vipassana. You know, you don't just meditate some, sit there, future life, precious. You don't do that. You do think that and focus on evaluating the value of your evolutionary moment as a precious human being, and among human beings, one with liberty and the opportunity to the teaching of enlightenment, to how to become, how to change yourself and transform yourself into the butterfly of an enlightened being. So you do think that, but you also vipassana, you look into yourself and you look and find those attitudes which we believe that our mind is not over matter. You know, it's like the person who is like, you know, eating organic food and taking Chinese medicine and doing this and that, and then they get a little sick and they rush to the hospital. And they get chemotherapy and they get all this stuff meanwhile, and they get killed by our ridiculous medical system, which is a business, actually, and is not a healing profession, really, except for the very few people who manage to get through the boot camp of medical school, bonding with their guild, instead of like really developing their compassion to basically really try to take care of people. Which, unfortunately, is what has happened in our country, because we're really in worse shape than we were when he told me that. So in other words, you meditate that you kind of don't really have the confidence of your own mind. You try to find where is that lack of confidence. Because you realize this elite that is telling us that we're nothing at death, and like acting like, you know, Daniel Dennett, you know, Richard Dawkins. I mean, these guys are like, we got Oxford, you know, British accent, you know. You know, these guys are like really arrogant. And they tell us with strong conviction, and it's like a guy with a white coat. And you have to believe that, you know. From childhood, they're like high priests. They're like high priests. And actually, even they in their universities, they are the natural scientists. They're the high priest guys. And the psychologists, the way they show how important they are is they sacrifice animals. They make ritual sacrifices. Slice the brain and watch where that dye is going. That's going to help me and make you enlightened. I'm going to get a drug out of that. You take it and you'll be the Prozac out. And you won't even mind. And you'll be fine until you die. And then you're really fine because you won't exist. I mean, that's the kind of system we're in. You have to realize. And that is in us. It's in our minds that we don't really believe. You know, we watch The Matrix and we see Neo look at the little boy bending the spoon in that scene when he's going to see the Oracle. And it's like fantasy, you know. Nobody believes that. The mind is over matter. And I'm very frustrated myself after 50 years of studying Buddhism, and I can't levitate still. No, I'm really frustrated. Because that way, well, that would be a good way to win a debate. Of course, they'd probably arrest you and dissect you. But, which is maybe why we can't do that. But we should be doing miracles. And actually, according to the environmental scientists, we have to do some miracles in the next decade or two, or we're doomed. You know, our grandchildren at least are doomed. Maybe we can sneakily think, oh, I won't be here, like George Bush said. But actually, we will, because we'll be reborn here as the Greenland ice cap comes crashing down. Main Street. Seriously. So I particularly don't like people who claim to be saying Buddhism. We don't need, we have modern Buddhism. We don't need former and future life. I think it's really misleading, and it's very, very unfair to the population that needs to hear about this, you know. And it isn't a religious thing. And they pretend that the reason they're so brave and they don't do that, I'm like Sam Harris, I'm against religion, but I'm still a Buddhist. Of course they can call themselves a Buddhist, but, you know, they're not really Buddhist because they don't exist. They are going around acting like they don't exist, so they can do whatever. What you realize if you don't, what's wrong with a psycho? A psycho thinks, psychopath, sociopath, they think that there's no consequence to what they do. They're not really present to their own actions. That makes them reckless and irresponsible. And it's like our whole culture is reckless and irresponsible. We don't turn off, and then we act like, oh, there's nothing we can do about it. Have you studied the recent history of Germany? Angela Merkel, who is some kind of green Tara, you know, she's a real green Tara, Angela Merkel. She brought Dalai Lama right in the chancellor's house, and the Chinese were having a bird outside, you know. And she brought him right in. She's so great. Her own foreign minister was ready to go to China and draw a salary from them and have her busted as chancellor. Well, she saw Fukushima. She turned off every nuke in Germany just like that. And then she switched the subsidy from the fossil fuel industry just like that and gave it to distributed, you know, solar panels. And within 10 years, less than 5 years, there was cheap electricity all over the place, so much so that the stocks of the centralized utilities burning their coal and fuels of different kinds went down through the toilet. So then they all got all upset and said, this is a disaster. So our culture is so sick that it's a disaster for people to have cheap, free, and non-polluting electricity. That's a disaster. Because it doesn't fit their model of their elite that makes money out of the destructive system. Do you realize that? So we could do that here. We could do that here. But you know what? The Koch brothers have assured that you can't put solar panels on your house in Arizona, Nevada, or Florida. No, you pay a penalty. You have to pay because they've made fake populist, seemingly populist resolutions saying that you're free riding on the people who are paying too much to the utilities because they made some stupid nuke that they had to put away and you have to pay for it. And so then they pass a and then they have people in the legislature that they own. They have a bunch of political serfs that they own that are making laws like that. So you can't even buy a cheap. Instead of subsidizing you, they're doubly and triply subsidizing the nasty people who are wrecking the planet. You get it? Why is there for one Vermont dropout Jewish guy from Brooklyn saying we need a political revolution? Why is he talking that? Because we're in the grip of these fascists, actually. I'm sorry. I know that. But this has to do. I know some of you are elder, and therefore this will affect your future life. Because you'll be reborn somewhere underneath one of the David Koch pumping machines and the pollution will go down there when you're in the womb and you'll grow up with three eyes and an extra ear and I don't know what, like in China right now. So you're not getting out of the consequence of this, so you need to stand up and make a revolution. Okay? Even if you're elder, you can't go thinking, well, yeah, gee, wait, my grandkid, I'm so sorry, but I won't be here. Like everybody's doing, and letting this thing go on, this charade go on. So that's the thing, you know. Maybe I should stop, you know. Like, I don't know. I'm not running for office myself, but I probably should. So that's the thing, that you really need this former and future life. And the former and future life is not a, be back on the topic. Former and future life is not a blind faith thing. It's an empirical thing. It's a scientific claim. Now, the Buddhism has a wonderful disclaimer about all scientific theories, which fits very well with Karl Popper's idea that all seeming theories are hypotheses based on previous experience and data and so on, and awaiting falsification and modification and paradigm shift based on more data and more experience. And there is no absolute law about the nature of the relative world. And Buddhism has the same hermeneutical principle that they proclaimed, finally they caught up with it in 1926 in Copenhagen. It would be Denmark that they'd catch up with Buddha in India. No, they just caught up. They're backward, because we're backward. The Western society is backward. And which is that deep reality or ultimate reality is inaccessible to conceptualization, which includes mathematics and scientific theories. And scientific theories are only relational, dealing with relational contextual things, and therefore they're always awaiting a different context, and they can always be disproved. So, you know, it isn't that that's an absolute thing about former and future life. But in looking at the evidence and people's memories and your continuity and the nature of your consciousness and your fact that when you fall asleep and lose consciousness, you then go into a dream. And in a dream, you think you have eyes and ears again, and you hear and see things. So your mind can reproduce a body, actually. Everyone here has had a dream. So you know that your mind produced one when your ordinary senses were asleep. You were produced a new set of senses, and you saw something in the dream, and you heard something, and you smelled something, etc. Rarely smell and touch, but you can smell and touch. Right? So if your mind can do that every day, what's the big deal about then you, when you die, you don't have the body, but your mind can keep doing that. And actually, in the Book of the Dead, which very clearly analyzes this beautifully, which is, I mean, it's not, shouldn't be called the Book of the Dead, it's called the Book of Natural Liberation, by learning something in the between state. And in that it says, you become 9 times more intelligent the minute your mind is free of your brain. Because, you know, the brain has, it's not just Alzheimer's, there's a lot of plaque and weird things in the brain, especially eating bad food in America, with the bad food industry and the bad agriculture, Monsanto-dominated agriculture industry, we eat a lot of bad food. And so the brain is like dampened down. So the mind gets free and you're immediately 9 times more intelligent. And they warn you, they say, when you that means you become immediately clairvoyant and telepathic. So they say, don't get mad at Uncle Joe at your funeral when you're floating around. And Uncle Joe is going, oh, Bob died. I'm so sad. It's terrible. Oh, he was such a great guy. And then you're reading his mind and he's saying, good riddance. I'm sick of that guy. I don't have to listen to his jokes anymore and be berated about my future life. That's great. I got rid of him. And then you can, the ambivalence and the subliminal levels in people's minds, you become totally aware of when you're a ghost. Apparently in that brief period. And don't get upset, because it's bad for you to get upset. And everybody's ambivalent. People always have 2 or 3 things in their mind. And then when the lama or the priest or the rabbi, whoever it is like going droning on about whatever and thinking about their beer that they're going to get in a minute and how boring it is, don't be upset with them. They're still reciting the right verses. They tell you that. Because you get much smarter. Your mind, without the brain, it lives in a hologram of subtle energy. And your mind is incredible. Your minds are all incredible. Why? Why do you know? What's the proof that your mind is incredible? You picked a human embodiment. Do you think that's an obvious thing to do? If you're paranoid or you're greedy or something, why aren't you a crocodile or a rhinoceros? That's like it's like being born as a Sherman tank. That would be good. Who would come like a little dinky human with weird fingers and like running around? Why would you do that? Why would you choose to be a human? Did you ever think about it? Do you think it's because we think it's such a normal thing? But a crocodile looks at a human and they just see like too many bones and not that much meat. It's like they'd much rather eat an antelope than a human. And like and so we are weird, you know. Look at us, we have these 2 eyes and it's all up here in our head, can't see behind ourselves, and fingers that are very fragile, no armor on the skin, no fingernails, teeth are tiny unless we're vampires in the movie. I mean, we're like wimpy characters, humans. But we know, we have more fun in bed, actually, than crocodiles. But you wouldn't know that automatically when you're in the Bardo. You wouldn't really know that. You might see some couple on Fifth Avenue or down the street here, like getting it on, you know, wonder what they were doing. And then you land in the womb by getting involved with it. So that means you have a certain, I mean, you've all read the Book of the Dead, you're a Buddhist, I can be a little like this. My wife is not here to scold me. You know, that if you've ever seen those movies, like about elephants getting it on, it's terrifying. Terrifying. She doesn't want to have anything to do with it. She runs away like this, knocking trees over as she goes. And he runs after her, and he's got a big hard on which she steps on as he goes. But he doesn't notice. He's so wound up. Finally, he catches her, and she's like, it's terrible. No foreplay. No fun. No caress. No kisses. Trunk is getting in the way. It's really awful. But humans, you know, we have these fingers, we can touch each other, you know, we're sensitive, but it's not an obvious choice. But we have tremendous brains and we can think it through, we can imagine all kinds of things, have fantasies. But it's an amazing form of life that you all are, you know. And if you stop to think that you are not just the product of like, you know, a drop of sperm and an egg, you know, but you chose that form and you elaborated yourself to that form. And that's why in Buddhism they say, in Buddhist karma theory, which is a biological scientific theory, it's not a mystical thing, it's a biological theory. And you get to be human because as those other animals, you were more ethical. You made little choices. You restrained certain greeds and hostilities. And you sort of let the antelope go. You know, you didn't really fight that badly with Olawan. You were like more vulnerable and you were looking for more fun in a different way. And you weren't just like reveling and dominating your niche and just eating what was in front of you until you died. You were ethical. So ethicality is the cause of your human form. We are essentially ethical beings. That is Shakyamuni Buddha's secular ethics. Like His Holiness has elaborated a nice secular ethic for the materialist humans on the basis of the helplessness of the human infant, the generosity of the human female to lend her body to the baby to live there for nearly a year rent-free. Which the males are not about to do. But the females are more advanced on the bodhisattva path, so they do. They accept a total stranger. You know, it could be Donald Trump being born in there. You don't know. You have no idea. He could be in there and ready to go bankrupt at the age of 3. There's no guarantee. But then the human females allow that to happen. That's an amazing piece of generosity. It's incredible. So that is, the human form is based on ethicality. If you're beautiful, it's based on your having been patient with a bunch of annoying people instead of angry with them. Beauty comes from patience, right? Third paramita. And wealth, if you're wealthy, it's because you were generous in your previous life. They have marvelous rules. Those are rules about it. And there's all kinds of subtle ones, which I don't understand. Maybe you can explain to me. Apparently, if wherever you live, it's messy. You have a messy desk, messy office. It's because in previous life you gossiped too much. And I don't really know why. I can't figure that one out. There's all kinds of specific little things like that. Okay? So when you meditate on your preciousness, which if you do realistically, now realistic worldview, yeah, some of these people who try to pretend that Buddha didn't teach former and future life, they are acting like, and Buddha therefore knew about materialism, and he was really just a modern materialist avant la lettre, so to speak. They, as I say, they're always pretending it's some sort of blind faith thing. But actually, it's an empirical thing that you have this former and future life. Your mind is energy. Oh yeah, but I have to criticize one thing about Buddhism. Now, in exoteric Buddhism, like Dharmakirti and people, in order to prevent materialistic people from sort of disregarding the nature of the mind, they make a big fuss that mind and matter are opposites. And they're sort of interactive, but they're categorically different sort of things. And then they get into this thing that mind is non-material. But this was millennia before the idea of the convertibility of energy and matter, right? E equals MC squared type of thing, you know? And so by matter, they mean some kind of solid thing, you know, static thing. And then mind is not that, you know? But that's the exoteric thing. But in esoteric Buddhism, and so therefore, when they do that in debating with the materialists, it's very unhelpful, actually. It doesn't actually help in the modern period. Because the materialists go around saying, well, wait a minute, how can a non-material thing matter? How can a non-material thing affect a material thing? It sort of doesn't compute to them, and they'll never get there. I've been in those science conferences, and the scientists who love His Holiness are trying to be polite, and you know they're trying to be nice because they love being in His presence, although they don't really respect Him intellectually, actually, I'm sorry, but they do not. They think that He's pre-modern, and you know He's traditional, and they think He's like Buddha taught Mahayana, Buddha taught Tantrayana, they know better. They know, oh, Mahayana was made up by Nagarjuna, who was trying to forge some texts, you know, with ridiculous, rude things they make up about Buddhism. You know, whereas Buddha taught, of course, Mahayana Buddhism, Shakyamuni taught it, but he withheld it for four centuries because he was a good sociologist, and he saw that the lunatic Indians, if they were handed non-duality when they were tribal monistic people with a caste system, they would use it to rationalize their stupid caste system. So he wanted to create a separate, he wanted to create holes in the social fabric, which were then take the male warriors especially, the women, they're more advanced, so they don't need it, but the males are really bad trouble in militaristic cultures, and so get them to join the monastic mendicant order, and instead of beating up their wives, they can beat their own heads on the wall and attain enlightenment. That's a brilliant strategy. Really brilliant. So he withheld Mahayana non-dualism for four centuries, and Tantrayana for eight centuries he withheld. But he taught, of course he taught it, because a Buddha, what is a Buddha? Oh yeah, that's another topic I wanted to address. If the title of this is there enlightenment without former and future lives, then you have to just ask, what is enlightenment? So what is a Buddha? You all here have studied with Lama Sopa, you're at Maitripa. A Buddha is not just an ordinary human being who had a light bulb pop off in his head. No way. A Buddha is a kind of really, it's not a god either. It's a kind of extraordinary being. Now, you've all been in love, right? Everybody here has been in love, at least briefly. And when you're in love, for a while, you're identified with the beloved, right? That beloved was more precious to you than your very self, if it was true love, right? You all had that. So you know that the human being, with their incredible imagination, they can expand and identify with another being. Right? People in war, buddies, even guys do, and they get into their platoon, you know, and therefore they go berserk when one member of their platoon is killed and they shoot up a whole village and things like that, because they expand their sense of identification. On football teams, they get into it, right? So the human being has this expandable and contractible sense of identification, right? Everybody agrees on that? A Buddha is a being who has expanded that to include all life. Okay? It isn't a person who has had a mystical experience where everything disappeared. I want to make that point. That is Tsongkhapa's major point. I want to make that clear, because we're all so escapist. We're all so tired and fed up with things that we all have a little bit this tendency, and you can hear it in the popular Buddhism a lot, to space out. It's a space. Empty space. Space like equipoise samadhi. I want samadhi. And there's even some people running around said, I can do what I want because I realized emptiness. Meaning they disappeared. Right? So there's a wrong view that enlightenment means that you get this experience where everything dissolves under analysis. You have a strong enough concentrated mind and everything seems to dissolve under analysis and you have this space like equipoise samadhi. And you feel you realized emptiness because there wasn't anything there. It was all empty. You weren't even there. But actually you were, because you're the one who got there, right? So then you go around and say, oh, I experienced it's all one. Nobody was there. I'm so enlightened. And oh, gee whiz, everybody came back. That's annoying. But I'll go back there automatically when I die. So meanwhile, the rest of my life, since I experienced everything disappear and it was all one, I'm holier than you. And therefore, I need a Cadillac. And I want to be the guru. I want to teach everybody because I'm enlightened and I can do what I want. That's totally wrong and totally stupid. And anybody who doesn't know that emptiness itself is empty, and the last thing that disappears is the state of disappearance. And when the state of disappearance disappears, what's happening? You're back here with all of us. Okay? And actually, you realize that we are all in a state of disappearance, but we're sitting here. And then, well, we're all disappeared. We're all in nirvana. And we're here like in an illusory manner. And then one person steps on your foot, and that's really unpleasant. And then they look really miserable, and that's unpleasant because you're identifying with them. So their pain is your pain. That's really a rough order. And that's what I call that the expensive oneness. The one where you're all one with everything and there's nothing there. It's just space. It's cheap. It's a narcissism. It's all me. I'm vast and near Vikalpa Samadhi. Right? And there's nobody else around, so I don't have to worry about them. When I come back, I can maintain the caste system and demand service from the lower castes. Right? That's a fake one. The real one is, it all disappeared because I was wrongly perceiving every being as separate from everything else. When it all comes back, suddenly I don't have a boundary and I'm everybody. And they say Buddha perceives every other living being like a mother perceives her only beloved child. Did you just focus on that? Have you been a mother? Have you observed a mother in your family if you happen to be male? And you notice how much they worry about the little one? And then all beings like that, that's a lot of worry. In order to do that, you have to have a very special kind of Prozac, Zoloft. You have to have bliss, actually. Luckily, your own cells and your own clear light in your cells, your own subatomic energies are bliss, fortunately. At least that's what Buddha said, and I hope it's true. I'm still hoping. You know, you let it all go and it's all bliss, the basic level of reality. Clear light of the void means it's only known by bliss. It is bliss. So you're all bliss. I think actually your health is your bliss. You know, your health is. If your body is strong and healthy, it means that the cells like each other because they're all blissful in the body. If you get depressed and you think, oh, my hand doesn't want to be on my wrist, and then you start to get sick. You know that. Look at Mr. Bliss over here, astronomy bliss. He wants to say he doesn't believe in future life. Just to provoke me. He wants to do that. I know him.
I've already planned it.
Yeah. So that's it. So Buddhahood, therefore, is something that is like an evolutionary goal. When you take Bodhisattva vow, you commit to 3 incalculable aeons of lifetimes to become a Buddha. Therefore, how can you do that in one life? You know, if you are a psychologist, if you go to a shrink and you say, oh, I'm so great, I was down at my trip and I took a vow to save all beings, and that guy will give you a tranquilizer. He'll give you Librium, and he'll say, if you insist, you can go down to the ward and you can have a bed next to Josephine and Napoleon and Jesus down there because you're going to save all beings, but you don't have time because you don't really exist, and B, you're going to be dead soon. So how do you have time to save all beings? You don't. The only reason you would take a Bodhisattva vow is if it's your common sensual reality, consensual reality, that you're here forever because you have this infinite continuum. There's no energy is destroyed. Your consciousness is energy. And worse, you're here forever with everybody else. They're going to be there forever. You're going to be in this lecture forever. In that uncomfortable chair. And I'm going to be hoarsely talking forever. So we better figure it out and get the insight and forget about it. To take a break. You follow me? So then once that's the case, you're there involved with everybody else forever. And as you gradually become more and more enlightened, you identify with more and more of them. And you realize that they are all your mothers, you're all their mothers. Then you want it to be ideal, your relationship. What is the ideal relationship with another being? You love them and they love you. What is the worst relationship with another being? You hate them and they hate you. You know, you're there, you're out for yourself, they're out for their self. And it's as one friend of mine used to say, when they would bring out the food, every bodhisattva for himself. Which is not a bodhisattva, of course. The Buddha land is where every bodhisattva wants to feed every other bodhisattva. So I call it the John Belushi food fight universe. You throw the dessert at the other people. Okay? So therefore, can there be enlightenment without future life? Obviously not. Because enlightenment is an infinite condition, a sense of infinite being. But not an infinite being in some space, an infinite being with space filled with sentient beings, sensitive beings, in order to, and therefore compassion, making those sensitive beings reach bliss and get rid of suffering, which is luckily only produced by their failure to know their true condition, which is bliss. According to Buddha, that's Buddha's good news, by the way. Asian people are not masochistic. They wouldn't have listened to some guy saying, you're stuck in suffering forever, as the poor Pope, previous Pope thought was the case. They wouldn't have listened to that. Asian people like to have fun. Even Chinese people. They don't just eat fortune cookies. They like to have fun. Confucius, they asked him, what would he most like to do in life? He said, go down in the springtime to the bend in the river by the earth altars and have the young boys and girls come out with feathers and flutes and dance and sing while I drink a bottle of wine. That's Confucius. So don't tell me that Chinese people want to just work in your apple factory. They don't. Therefore, it's obvious, unless you want to narrow down your definition of Buddhahood to being like a professor or something, some smart, ordinary human, some real American who has a PhD and thinks they're smarter than Buddha, which unfortunately is what most of my colleagues do think. They do. The Buddha didn't have a PhD from Harvard or Oxford. So, poor guy. He was like running around in ancient India speaking Sanskrit, you know, like, what could that mean? You know, didn't know mathematics. He actually did know every kind of mathematics. Okay, so that's it. Any questions? That's it. That's all. I don't want to berate you. I got to go. I got to take a flight at 6 a.m. in the morning. And that's the thing. So please tell everybody that they're going to be here forever. And therefore, some wealthy old ones who are going to vote for some lunatic Republican, tell them that that Republican's going to screw over their social system, and when they get reborn, they'll be like born in the street. And they're going to be there to suffer, and they'll be poor and demented. So they should have a revolution. And thank you. He's giving me candy to shut me up, maybe. Let's do it. So any question? Anybody have any question? Actually, it helped my voice. Actually, I didn't croak as bad as yesterday. Any question?
Water there if you want.
Oh, that's okay. So thank you. Any question? Anybody want to debate? Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I was reading in your...
You were reading?
Yeah, in your discussion you were having with Stephen Batchelor at one point, and I think it was you who made the argument that no one else...
You put the mic right in your mouth, you know, like...
I'll trust it.
Okay, he'll tell me.
Yeah. I guess that there's only... Well, I can't remember what you said, but basically that there isn't anyone else who's... contradicted Buddha or had the similar realization and said otherwise?
Right, so it's the debate between you and Stephen Batchelor. Buddhism without beliefs.
There's no debate. Whenever he sees me, he says, oh, I don't really disbelieve. How about a agnostic? He always says that to avoid debating with me. But what about him?
So, go ahead.
Well, it was more that I'm curious if you don't think that there's been other, you know, intellectuals or other perhaps enlightened or semi-enlightened beings that haven't come up with other theories of how we exist, like Plato or other...
Plato believed in metempsychosis.
I'm just curious what your thoughts are on those other people and their views that may differ or not.
So there's so many wise philosophers and wise people, and they have different theories. So how come?
Actually, the majority of human beings in history have accepted the fact of continuity. Scientists themselves say that no energy can ever be destroyed, right? The law of thermodynamics. It's just they're denying energy to consciousness. Consciousness is supposed to be not energy, because the ignorant person, Buddha's analysis is that the misknowing person thinks that at the point of the deepest point of their subjectivity is some unchanging, fixed, identifiable thing, like a fixed self that never changes. So that when you're 90 and you see a picture of yourself sitting so beautifully there in your seat, if you saw a picture of it and then you go back and remember, oh, I was there debating Professor Thurman, and then you would feel at 90 that you have the exact same subjectivity that you have now. But that is an illusion. Actually, we totally change all the time. So there is nothing that doesn't change. Therefore, your consciousness is not a fixed thing detached from the flow of energies. Your consciousness is part of the flow of energies. It's a particular energy continuum of its own. And therefore, there is no reason why that should become nothing at any point, when the rule in nature is that all things have continuity. Right? So and that's not a blind faith belief. The realistic worldview in Buddhism, you know what it means to believe in? Believe in causation. That's what it means. Buddha said that all things have a cause in the relative world, and he understood how those cause and effects work, and that's our job to learn that. Okay? So that's not a really hard thing to do. But that point of identity inside yourself and myself, because I'm not pretending to be more enlightened than you, I'm just used to discussing my unenlightenment maybe more frequently than you are. And so that point of where it seems to be that I'm an unchanging identity in there, that's what Buddha said is the source of my trouble, because that's not real. It's not there. Mm-hmm. And that's where people go to isolate themselves, to withdraw from connection. When they get depressed, that's why they think that the world is against them. It's also awful. When they get elated, they think that they're some kind of megalomaniac. It is this fixed self that he saw as our root problem. You follow me? Mm-hmm. So, however, the relative self he never denied. So he never said that you don't exist. He just says you don't exist the way you think you exist. You exist as a flow, not as a fixed thing in the middle of the flow. Do you follow me?
Yes.
That's his whole insight. So in that light, all of the great philosophers in the world have more or less argued for continuity. There's very few who have gone psycho, like modern West has done. And also, notice this, there's no other culture in our recorded history anyway that we know about that has brought the planet to the brink of destruction, right, the way we have. We're supposed to be so superior, but actually, in 15 minutes, the entire planet could be annihilated with nuclear weapons by Russia and the US and China and North Korea and Pakistan and India and Israel. They could all destroy everything, right, with nuclear weapons in like 15 minutes. And the people who have them are a bunch of crazy politicians mostly. Right? So it's actually a miracle they didn't pull all the triggers already on that side. And on the other side, our greedy consumer society, which is the expansion, the industrial expansion of our greed and our desire and our dissatisfaction, has brought the planet to the melting point where we'll all be flooded out and there'll be no crops and where there billions will die, actually. Billions, not just millions, billions will die. So we are this culture, which exceptionally has an elite that says they have discovered nothing and that's where they're going, is wrecking the entire planet for everybody. And the majority, you said wise philosophers have different views. Yes, they analyze it in different ways. But you will find that the vast majority, except for these modern ones, have argued for continuity and the responsibility, therefore, of the person within that flow. Okay? I think you'll find that. For example, Jesus. Everyone goes on, I'm coming back, and you know, the rapture people and all this, he's going to come back and he's going to annihilate a lot of people in their sick idea. But actually, he believed in reincarnation because metempsychosis was a common knowledge in the Mediterranean in his day. Plato himself believed in metempsychosis, they call it. Pythagoras believed in metempsychosis. You know who didn't want to have future life? Mrs. Constantine. Mrs. Constantine, you know who Constantine was? He was the Roman emperor in the early 4th century, late 3rd, early 4th century, who codified Christianity when he took it, or used it to unify the empire. Instead of throwing him to the lions, he said he ordered everybody to be a Christian. And Mrs. Constantine said, wait a minute, I want you to ban reincarnation. And why? She had a long list of people she had executed. She didn't want them coming back to her court and giving her a hard time. So there was a guy called Origen, who was a church father, who totally had a theology of reincarnation in Christianity. And she said, I want his head. That's another one I'm going to execute. And Constantine didn't want to execute him, so he gave him a choice, which I won't discuss what it was. But he didn't kill him, actually, but he did mutilate him. So then that was why Christianity thinks they're not going to be, nobody's going to be reincarnated. So the church can hold you, but you're going to be reincarnated, heaven or hell or purgatory, until Pope Benedict banned purgatory. He just waved it like that guy on Saturday Night Live. He waved purgatory, no purgatory. Heaven or hell, that's it. And it's all going to be done in one life. He did. But that's just arbitrary. As I tried to point out, and I hope you thought it through, that it's not possible for something to become nothing. Right? It's like insane to think that you found nothing, because nothing isn't there. Okay, another question. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much for your talk. I really got
Thank
a lot
you.
Out of it.
Okay, I'll come close so I can hear you. Yeah.
The question is that...
Yes.
Why is it that certain people can recall past lives or details about past life experiences, but the majority cannot?
That's a very good question, and actually that relates to the way I have come, actually, to my surprise, to have my sort of understand a little bit about the Buddha. If you know the story of the Buddha, all versions of the story of the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree say that before he attained nirvana, which they describe as the exhaustion of contaminants in the mind, the detoxification of the mind, they describe total detoxification of the mind by delusions and so on. He remembered infinite previous lives of himself. And then second, he remembered infinite previous lives of others, and also all their future possibilities, which are not written in stone because it's not like an automatic fate. They have choices and things, and they could have longer and lesser, and he became aware of all of those options. So those two things happen. Why was it on the event horizon of nirvana, of realization? I mean, everything is nirvana. We're all in nirvana right now. It's fine, according to him. This is nirvana. So we better enjoy it. But on the event horizon of realizing that, removing the veils to that, he was able suddenly to remember infinite previous lives. And why? Why don't we, and this relates to why don't we remember them? Because we suffered a lot. We didn't like dying. We had all kinds of grief happening. You know, there's a lot of, like, why don't you remember when you broke your wrist or whatever it is that you had some mishap? You don't really remember the pain, right? That's a protective thing. You still remember I did that, but you don't really remember how it really, the agony that happened whenever something awful happened to you. And that's lucky, because otherwise you'd be terrorized, you know, that you might step on something or whatever. So at nirvana, what you realize is, I think I'll share this with you. At nirvana, what you realize is that you've always been in nirvana. Because nirvana is the uncreated, it has always been the case. And this delusory thing that we have, that we're this separate being fighting our way through life and worrying about death and doing all this, that's all a delusion, actually, that it's like that. Although there's a way of being still being there when you're not deluded, like a Buddha. But still, that's a delusion. So you realize that you were in bliss even when you were in hell. And you were creating the hell by being really isolated from others and walling yourself and imprisoning yourself within an iron shell or surrounding yourself with fire so other people couldn't bother you, get through the fire, but the fire was burning you, etc. It's like you were already in bliss because nirvana has always been the case. Do you know what I mean? You've understood things in your life, I bet. That when you understood them, I always knew that, but I wasn't paying attention. So apparently nirvana is the ultimate one of those. And then I'm going to conclude with this, which is because time, which is that is how I console myself for my rampant unenlightenment after 50 years of study. And my continuous misery and workaholism, or actually my wife calls it Buddhaholism. And I console myself with that, which is, when I do attain nirvana in some future life, probably, I will realize that I always was in nirvana. So I will re-remember this moment here with you, feeling unenlightened and frustrated that I didn't attain nirvana. And I realized that I was wrong the way I was interpreting my experience in this moment, and I was already in nirvana. Do you follow me? So I can remember it really vividly because it was another form of being in bliss. Do you follow me? So that's my consolation, and you should all be consoled with that fact. Although now you're sick and tired of this topic, and you're ready to go home and whatever, and watch CNN to see who won New York, or Hillary and Bernie debating, or what nonsense Trump said. So you're in this all these different moods. But someday you will revise your experience of this moment here, and you will enjoy it as being a way of being in nirvana. Right? So you'll have a really great time here, retroactively. You follow me? So don't worry. Did you have a question? What was your question? What was your question? So just say, talk.
So I really appreciated what you had to say about the American the medical model.
Oh, yeah.
And the problem of
the lack of healing, because it's a business, you said.
Yes.
So could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure.
I'm interested.
In the training for a Tibetan doctor, the first thing that you learn is compassion. And you're told, if you're motivated for wealth or status, don't be a doctor. That's the wrong profession for you. Only if you're motivated by compassion for suffering beings should you be a doctor. And then you'll be a good doctor if you get all the learning and all the skills out of that motivation. You'll be an excellent doctor, and you actually will be wealthy and you'll have status because people will really appreciate you. But never do it for those motives, because you'll be a lousy doctor and you'll harm people, actually, because you'll get sick of them and they'll come all funky and everything, and you will hate it. And so, but that would be like in our medical schools if they spent the first year studying the Hippocratic Oath only, uh-huh, and cultivating their motivation. Uh-huh. Instead of that, the people who do go to medicine, the majority of them who are motivated by compassion, they can't take the whole, you know, guild, the idea of they have to like bond with the other doctors, and basically they get alienated more and more from the patients, and they work for the pharma companies and the whole thing. And then the ones who have the compassion, they get disgusted and they go out and become acupuncturists and massage therapists, and we can find them, and they're helpful still, they're around. Because they can't take this system, you know. And not only that, but they won't train many doctors. They make it, oh, you're getting to medical school, that's really tough. They should be having thousands of them like they do in Cuba. They're sending them all over the world.
Yeah.
People want to help each other, and they should have millions of them, but they don't do that. Why? Because they make more money when they're scarce. They don't want to flood the market. It's all money, money, money.
Yeah.
And that is against healing. It's bad.
Yeah.
And it's unnecessary and it's wrong. And if you socialize it, single payer system, as Bernie would do, this will diminish those who are going there and they want to cut you open and give you a new heart in order so they can drive a bigger Cadillac or more of a BMW, or they'll give you a cesarean because they want to get it over with because they have a golf appointment. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to wait for you to go through your labor, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, etc. It's dangerous to have a baby in an American hospital now, statistically. Mm-hmm. It's safer to go home, mm-hmm, or go to France.
Okay.
That's really sick, and it's a huge expense. It's ridiculous. Uh-huh. We have become overtaken by fascism, actually, where corporation and government have unified, and the people have no defense. That actually is what has happened in America since Reagan completed by the coup d'etat of the year 2000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the giant robbery and crime committed in our name of the invasion of Iraq and the wrecking of the tenuous balance that exists in the Middle East, which is our doing, not Obama, the other moron.
Thank you.
Okay? Thank you. Yes.
I'm planning on being reincarnated as an Italian.
And oh, good. I like that.
I noticed that in all of your anecdotal examples tonight,
yes,
it was humans being reincarnated maybe in Georgia or Oregon.
But yeah.
Do you allow for other species or other solar systems?
Well, that would be... Okay, good. That's a comment. I don't need to say anything. That's fine. I was going to write a book, How to Get Reborn on Fifth Avenue. But that's so New York, you know. I think I should change it. How to Be Reborn in the Willamette Valley. Yeah. Okay? Okay, bye. Good night.
Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menlo Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share and post on your favorite social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in and hope to hear from you soon. Tashi Delay.